It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, far-right protesters in Brazil rioted at government buildings over the weekend claiming election fraud. We'll look at the story behind the headlines. First, as winter drags on and cabin fever settles in, finding things for kids to do may start to feel like a struggle. They can play outside, sure, for a while, but then what? How about your nearby museum for kids? Children's museums around Wisconsin are upgrading their facilities, updating their exhibits, and inviting families to join the fun. We're visiting three different museums from around the state to find out what's new and what's next, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Share a memorable experience at a children's museum for you or for when you were a kid, maybe. What do your kids say about visiting? Is there a children's museum you'd like to give a shout-out to? And what other activities and institutions do you go to when you're looking for that wintertime activity with your kids? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael McCorney is the chief executive officer for the Children's Museum of Eau Claire. Yesterday was the grand opening of their new building. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, congrats on the grand opening. Can you walk us through the front door? What do we see in the new Children's Museum of Eau Claire?
Sure. So when kiddos arrive, one of the first things that they'll notice and see are tall timbers. We actually have a product called Structural Round Timber that makes up our building structural system. And it's the kind of first system of its kind in the world, which we're really excited about. But it really evokes play as well for children at the new Children's Museum. They might not see this, but they also, it benefits them. So our entire energy system is actually 100% renewable energy from geothermal and over 300 solar panels on our building's rooftop. But then as they get into our front entrance, they see three different galleries of exhibits on our first floor. We have our Bitty City, which is like growing up in a small community. We also have a water exhibit called Waterworks, and then an area for the littlest kiddos called Toddler Forest. And then our second floor is actually more of a mezzanine. It's actually open to the first floor. And on that level, we have three exhibits as well. Body Smarts exhibit, which is all about the body with a larger-than-life digestive climber to climb through. And then also we have Shape Up, which is an area dedicated to exercise and fitness. And then finally, we have Explore and Discover, which is kind of our what inspired that design was our proximity to the Ice Age Trail. So we have a large fossil dig in that exhibit area. There's also a camping and fishing space. And then we have another area that's dedicated to kind of more historical artifacts.
Now, before we go into more of the exhibits there, the designing a new building for the Children's Museum, A, sounds like it'd be really exciting. B, it sounds like it'd be kind of daunting and scary. Could you tell us a little bit about what you did to figure out how this new institution or this new version of the institution would serve your local community?
Sure. Yeah. The biggest thing for us was we really had to identify what are the must-haves for us to build a new building and what do we want what do we want that building to offer? And so we went through that process and really identified what are the key things that we needed, that we lacked in our old building. Many of those, parking, very common in a downtown area. So we now have free parking for our guests in a parking ramp that is adjacent to the new museum, which is excellent. We also added much more natural lighting. And there's actually some really unique windows as well that kind of give the building a look of maybe Swiss cheese. So it fits really well in our state of Wisconsin.
Very thematic, yeah.
Yeah, as well. So, and then we worked with our community to really identify what are some of the experiences you'd want to see. And we even hosted some younger kiddos to come in and share their idea for exhibits they'd like to see in the museum. And actually some of what they shared made it into the final thing. We heard a lot of kids wanted something with dinosaurs or digging. So we made a fossil dig. And then also we had a small fire truck experience in the old museum, but kids really wanted a giant actual fire truck in the new museum. And so we brought that as well. And that was kind of a fun thing we had to source from the state of Ohio to actually salvage an old fire engine. So that was really exciting and fun as well. And we worked with just a great team of local contractors. We had actually two that partnered together to collaborate on this project, which was fantastic. And then a wonderful exhibit design firm, and then also numerous architects as well.
And you've got something called, I want to hear more about this, a sensory room there. This is a big part of the process. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so we've actually partnered with UW-Eau Claire and their special education department to create a space that is for children that may have sensory needs. And basically, the space is within our second floor, and it allows children, if they are having maybe a moment where they're overwhelmed, to go to an area to kind of work through that overstimulation and then positively re-engage back into the experience of our exhibits. And really our goal with that, and our goal with the whole building, is to make it as accessible and available to everyone. But also oftentimes in that situation, maybe in our old building, children would have to maybe leave, or parents would feel like they'd have to leave. Now they have a space where they can hopefully, calm and collect, and then move and return back to play as well. We're also providing kits for children with sensory needs that they can experience in the museum, and they can take that kit with them out into the exhibits as well if they should need it too. So it's a wonderful collaboration with our local university. It was actually, the entire design for the space was done by students with their professor. So we're really excited about what this will offer. And it was just a great partnership and project to work on.
Michael, thanks for sharing the new building with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for allowing me to.
That's Michael McCourney, Chief Executive Officer of the Children's Museum of Eau Claire. Michael joined us to talk about the grand opening of their new building. It's part of our tour today of children's museums around the state, checking in on what's going on. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are now or have ever been the parent of kids, younger kids in particular, did you rely on a local children's museum or visit them when you were traveling around the state or beyond? Do you have one in your local community that you want to put in a plug for? Love to hear from you. Or is there something else along these lines that you'd like to do on maybe that cold winter day where outdoor activities can only last so long? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Now we move to the Fox Valley. Casey Holdcroft is the marketing manager at the Building for Kids Children's Museum in Appleton. Casey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. We're excited to be here.
Give us a taste of the kind of things that families will experience at the Building for Kids.
Absolutely. So the Building for Kids is located right in downtown Appleton. We have two floors and over 30,000 square feet of exhibits for kids and families to come and explore. So when you walk in our front door, you can see our whole kids town is located there. So we have a credit union, a doll hospital. We have a place where you can go drive a big rig. And then we also have a STEM space located on our first floor. And then when you go up the stairs, you can find a whole lot more. Our second floor is quite a bit bigger than our first floor. But you can find things like a place for our youngest visitors to go. So those from ages 0 to 3, you can find an art studio, a water space, and lots more.
And you've got a new exhibit in the works, Food to Grow.
Yes, we are very excited to partner with Children's Wisconsin and Schreiber Foods to welcome a new permanent exhibit to the Building for Kids this coming fall. Like you said, it's called Food to Grow, and it's going to focus all on food sourcing, food choice, food equity, and really the overall cultural significance of food. So it's going to have 5 different areas, including a farm where kids can grow their own food, a market where they can sell it, a pantry, a kitchen where they can cook, of course, and then a table so that families or maybe perhaps some new friends made at the museum can all sit down together and eat.
I've got a cryptic note from our producer here. I understand from your office, Casey, you can hear children shouting fire every day, all day. What's going on there?
I always say it's one of the only places where you can work at a children's museum is where you can hear fire screamed all day and not be concerned because we have a huge life-size fire truck right outside our office. And so every day, that's what you hear is fire, quick, it's in the trees or it's on that building. And it's kids having a blast pretend playing.
Now, do you get, when I was a parent, especially of younger kids, I often visited local children's museums, or if I was on the road, on those bad weather days, especially in the winter. Is that something you get there a lot in Appleton?
Yes, absolutely. The Building for Kids is a great place to come on those days when the weather isn't quite cooperating with the trip outside. It's a great place to get out a lot of energy. We have a temporary exhibit right now at the Building for Kids, and it's called Planet Imagination. And it's in this really huge exhibit gallery space that we have, and it has a bunch of giant blue building blocks, and then it also has an obstacle course component. And so that's a great place to kind of get out that big play, those working on those motor skills, running around, burning off some energy. And so that's always a lot of fun, especially during the winter months.
Now, as a grown-up who spent time at children's museums with my kids, I had a lot of fun, too. Anything at Building for Kids that grown-ups and parents find particularly appealing?
Yes, so I am glad you asked. We actually have an adults-only night coming up at the Building for Kids later in February. So it's kind of that chance for either the adults who don't have kids, or maybe the adults who want a chance to come play at the museum without their kids, to come to the museum. And it's called Art Jam. So it's going to be all about focused on art and collaborative art. You'll have food, drinks, live music, all of that good stuff. And we always say that we have a crane at the museum, and that is one of our most popular exhibits, but it's honestly a very popular exhibit for adults more than kids sometimes, depending on the day. And so that's the chance when adults don't have to give up their spot at the crane for the next kid in line.
Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Casey Holdcroft, marketing manager at the Building for Kids Children's Museum in Appleton. We're taking a tour of children's museums around Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you want to tell us about your local children's museum or other institution that's a great place to take kids to, especially in these winter months. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Ellen is with us in Madison. Ellen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Ellen? Yep, loud and clear.
I worked at the first children's museum in Chicago on Michigan Avenue. My good friend Jean Unsworth was a professor at Loyola University, and her good friend decided they wanted to make this a plan. And we had small installations on the staircase where the library was kind enough to give us space. And eventually we ended up with a small room in the back where we could store some supplies. And we gave Saturday classes to participants in visualizing the museum, trying out our small, small compact little areas. And I worked there for 2 years. And when I did come to Madison, I actually was a volunteer in our children's museum when it was over in Bedford.
Excellent, Ellen. Thank you so much for sharing that experience. Some groundbreaking work at children's museums. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We are taking a tour of children's museums around the state and beyond. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to put in a plug, a shout out for a children's museum you've loved near or far? Do you work at one? No problem. You could share what's going on there with us. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Next stop, Madison. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We are visiting children's museums around Wisconsin. We have been to Eau Claire and Appleton. Just a minute, we'll head to Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you want to share a museum, maybe an experience going there, working there. 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on another caller now. Nancy is with us in the Northwoods by Eagle River. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. I was just going to plug the Children's Museum in Eagle River, which is the Northwoods Children's Museum. They have a fantastic display of a mine, a store. They have snowmobiling because we're known for the snowmobiling up here. The kids can actually ride a little snowmobile, and it's just an awesome children's museum. And it's how I actually got started with children's museums. And now I've been to several of them in Rhode Island and in Massachusetts.
Wow. Nancy, thanks for sharing that. Eagle River Children's Museum, the Northwoods Children's Museum at 800-642-1234. Now we'll head to Madison. Kia Carlin is the Vice President of Education and Community Engagement for the Madison Children's Museum. Kia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, you've got a lot going on there, it looks like. The Wonderground Project, the second phase building that finished up this fall. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, our big project during COVID, when we closed the museum for a little over a year, we decided to fast track adding more outdoor space to our museum, which had been a long-term goal, but we decided to double down on it and do it quickly and do it imaginatively and creatively with our community. So we, in the fall of 2021, opened the first phase of the Wonderground, which is a 10,000 square foot outdoor exhibit and play space on our property. This fall, we closed it for a month to build out even more fun climbing equipment, rope bridges, lots of ways for kids to move around, move their bodies, get active at the museum. It's a wonderful four-season outdoor play space. Of course, it's immediately adjacent to all of the indoor comforts you might need when taking your kids outside during the winter.
What kind of things are kids doing outside, especially in the winter season?
Well, we have, I think we boast Madison's only rooftop ice rink, and it's scaled for young kids who are just learning to skate. We've got double blade skates that strap on over whatever shoes and boots you're wearing already. That's up on the roof of our building. And then the Wonderground space has multi-story climbing structures, playhouses, slides, a historic log cabin family home that is one of the oldest surviving family home, European family structures in the state of Wisconsin. And coming up soon, as soon as we have a stretch of enough cold weather, we will be working with friends to add machine-made snow to the space, to add sledding hills. Last year, we had a luge run in the space. So it's a changing space that evolves with the seasons. And we're excited about spending the rest of the winter out there.
Well, sticking with the wonder theme, there's also a new project called Caretakers of Wonder. What is that?
Yes, and that's a project we're very excited about. And our visitors and public will get to see it further down the road. This was a national grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services to have us take the lead at Madison Children's Museum in working with a group of 9 children's museums from around the country to look at sustainability education and how to developmentally, in a developmentally appropriate way, how to get at some of the undergirding topics around climate change that are appropriate for young children, understandable by young children, and that come from a voice of hope and optimism and agency, and that we have the power to make things different. So it's sort of a climate change project that will never mention the word climate change, because we want to ground this in encouraging kids to play outside, learn to love nature and the outdoor world, to care for animals and other people, and develop their empathy skills. So we are excited to work both locally with Madison community advisors and partners at the University of Wisconsin, as well as with a network of 8 other children's museums from around the country that are joining us in this effort.
Yeah, I can think of a lot of bad ways to talk to kids about climate change. Kia, I know this is still in the works, but can you talk about the focus, what kind of things kids would experience in the final project?
Yes. Well, each museum will take on its own project. Here in Madison, there are 2 parts. Each museum is planning a way to improve its own carbon footprint. So looking at investing in renewables, I applaud Michael and his team at Eau Claire for already running on 100% renewable energy. That's a goal of ours. In terms of the public-facing aspect, we are working on an exhibit. The working title is Rhythms of Life, and it will be designed for young kids, and again, to just encourage kids to explore and delight in the interconnectedness of the natural world and the human world, and really, really grow up with a sense of caring for everybody on this planet and everything on this planet.
And what is the timeline for the Caretakers of Wonder project?
This startup grant is a 2-year project. We'll be convening our first meeting of all of these advisors and museum partners in February of this year. Our exhibit that we are working on is slated to open in spring of 2024. So it'll be a little over a year before you can come into our museum and see the new exhibit, but there's a lot of exciting work going into it.
In just our last minute or so, Kia, I mean, as parents, we might think of a children's museum as a good place to take the kid to play, maybe especially in bad weather. Can you talk a little bit more about what you see as the role of a children's museum in serving a community?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you could hear it from all of the museums that were mentioned today in this program. We grow out of our community. We all reflect our local communities. We want everyone who visits to feel welcome and included. We want kids to have a joyful, sort of adventurous playtime in the museum with a lot of open-ended activity. And I know I've been talking up our outdoor space a lot. We have 3 floors of indoor exhibits that are beautifully temperate in any weather as well. So lots to do here.
Kia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kia Carlin is the Vice President of Education and Community Engagement for the Madison Children's Museum. We've been taking a tour of children's museums around Wisconsin, finding out what's going on. Before Madison, we took stops in Eau Claire and in Appleton. And there is still time for you to keep sharing your favorites. Put in a plug for your local community children's museum or maybe an experience you've had elsewhere in the state, elsewhere on this planet at a children's museum. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tell us about it. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear or read, I guess, your stories there. Coming up after the news, far-right extremists rioted against Brazil's capital on Sunday, drawing some comparisons to the January 6th insurrection here in the U.S. We'll find out what's going on behind the headlines. Remember, you can follow all these great conversations live or archived at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the author of a new book makes the case that we should use technology to make our future more human and less virtual. Now, hundreds of protesters stormed Brazil's capital buildings in Brasilia this past Sunday in support of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro. Riots come just 1 week after former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's re-inauguration as Brazil's new president. Here in the U.S., the Brazil riots have drawn some comparisons to the January 6th insurrection after the 2020 election. Cynthia Arnson is a distinguished fellow and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin American program. Cindy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Great to join you.
Can you give us a little bit of the context coming out of Brazil's election and leading up to this weekend's riots?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, Lula da Silva won the election in the second round by a very narrow majority, you know, mere percentage points in the single digits, 1-2%. This was the closest election in Brazil's history. And the president who was defeated, Jair Bolsonaro, had vowed that there would be fraud. And this is something that he has hammered on for years, really, to detract from the credibility of Brazil's electoral system. And he refused to concede. He did leave Brazil. He did not appear at Lula's inauguration. Typically, one president hands the presidential sash to the next. He instead is in Florida. And the lead up, I think, was that he had encouraged his supporters to protest. There were people camped out outside military barracks asking essentially the armed forces to come in and stage a coup to prevent Lula from taking power. And those people showed up in Brasilia, the capital of the country, on Sunday. In many ways, an assault that was foretold that authorities did know about and did precious little to actually stop.
Now, these fraud claims, as I understand it, Bolsonaro's party did okay in the legislative election, but he lost the presidency. Does there appear to be any legitimacy to these claims of fraud?
There really there is no legitimacy to these claims. As a result of his claiming fraud for so long, the military actually was among those that examined the electoral system. The United States played a role as well, looking into the possibilities that that code would be hacked or somehow the results would be manipulated. And the electoral system was seen to be completely reliable. And this has been the conclusion since the 1990s when the system was put in place. And, you know, as we've seen in other elections, including here in the United States, the claim that an election has been fraudulent, has been stolen from you, can really stoke supporters who communicate with one another on social media, on certain apps, and start spinning all kinds of conspiracy theories about how the fraud took place and what kind of government Lula was going to install once he was inaugurated. And of course, these false claims and the fake news phenomenon is well known in Brazil and other parts of Latin America around the world. And it is, I think, a serious threat to democracy in the Americas, but in other places around the globe.
And protesters, Bolsonaro protesters, have called, as you touched on the military to take over, reinstitute the former president. This has happened before. There's a 1964 military coup, as I understand, in Brazil that ultimately led to a military rule of the country for, what, 2 decades? Are people looking back at that and thinking, yeah, let's do something like that again?
Well, his supporters, I think, clearly want that. And Bolsonaro was very much in favor of the military during his time as a legislature and praised the coup and praised the military government, including its human rights abuses. As you say, it was in power from 1964 when it seized power from a democratic government and didn't give up power until 1985, so 21 years. The military has not acceded to those calls. It has resisted those calls. The military was not involved in trying to put down the protest. And the real question, I think, and what is being investigated by the current Lula government is the complicity or the charges or the possible complicity of the federal police that are in charge of guarding the presidential palace and the Congress and the Supreme Court. And, you know, you mentioned early in the interview, the January 6th events that took place in the United States 2 years ago. This in many ways was more severe because it was the seat, it was the Supreme Court, it was the presidential palace and the legislature, you know, the equivalent being not just the U.S. Congress, but the White House and the Supreme Court as well. So this and the vandalism, I mean, if you've seen the images on the internet, they're quite horrific. The kinds of damage that was done, including to very important works of art that were hanging in those buildings. Luckily, no one was there, so people were not injured. But the accusation, I think, is that somehow these busloads of protesters were able to get through. Their intent was clear. Police did not stop them. There have been pictures of police chatting with the protesters rather than trying to stop them, of, you know, buying a drink instead of doing anything. And so these are all issues that the Lula government is looking into. There have been about 1,500 people arrested. Those are the reports. I'm not sure of the exact figure as of now, but they are clearly going to investigate and prosecute the rioters. How easy that will be, I can only imagine. But they are also looking into the way in which pro-Bolsonaro political figures, including the governor of Brasilia, as well as members of the police or intelligence services, may have, at a minimum, acquiesced in allowing these people into the building. In direct, I think, contrast to what we saw with the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, in which the Capitol Police were actively trying to keep the violent mobs from entering the Capitol building.
Talking to Cindy Arnson from the Wilson Center's Latin American program, looking at the riots in Brazil's capital, attacks on multiple government buildings there over the weekend. Cindy, stepping back for a moment, why we in the United States might be interested in what's going on in Brazil. This is the second most populous country in our hemisphere, a pretty substantial economy in its own right. How important is Brazil to us here in the United States?
Brazil is incredibly important to the United States. As you mentioned, it is the largest economy in South America. It has the, as many people probably have heard, the Amazon rainforest, which is an absolutely critical part of the effort to fight climate change and to allow the forest to regenerate. During the previous government, the Bolsonaro government, deforestation took on unforeseen dimensions. Lula has pledged to dial back on that. But, you know, in terms of a lot of U.S. goals, whether it's the defense of democracy or the effort to combat the global changing climate, Brazil is a very important partner of the United States. It's also an important actor on the world stage, in whether that's in the UN or, you know, as a member of various coalitions of developing countries. And, you know, there are lots of economic ties between the United States and Brazil. Brazil has China as its main export partner, mostly because of commodities. But what happens in Brazil and the attack on democracy in Brazil is something that really is of great interest to the United States and certainly of interest to the Biden administration, which has made the defense of democracy in the Americas and around the world a real priority of its foreign policy.
We've mentioned the parallels between January 6th and what happened this weekend in Brazil. Is there a sense that people who organized this, people who participated, were inspired by what happened on January 6th? We know some of the people in the U.S., the Steve Bannons and Ali Alexanders, have encouraged these kind of protests, called in some cases for martial law, a military coup in Brazil. Is this U.S.-centric, or was there some inspiration there?
Well, you know, it's in the broadest sense, Bolsonaro drew inspiration from Donald Trump, a president who he admired greatly, who some have rumored, you know, he's in touch with now that he's in Florida, in Orlando, and as last reported, in the hospital. But the storming of the Capitol, the stoking of the false narrative around a stolen election. I mean, these are things very much taken from the Trump administration playbook and Trump and his close advisors. There were, you know, during the riots, you know, Steve Bannon was on his network and whatever and did not call on people to stand down, appeared to be encouraging all of this. So I think that the really kind of globally detrimental effect of what took place in the United States is reflected in what just happened. There's certainly a demonstration effect that is very corrosive to democracy and not an export that we should be particularly proud of.
We just have a minute or so left, Cindy. Now, that 1964 coup I mentioned, as I understand it, the U.S. was supportive of that coup. This weekend's events, what has been the response from U.S. leadership in the international community, again, just in our last minute or so?
Sure. There has been swift condemnation, not only from the Biden administration. Joe Biden actually talked to Lula, pledged U.S. support. It was long reported that Lula would be invited to the White House. The invitation is there now for February, for early February, just in a couple of weeks. But not just the United States, Latin American countries, including countries that are not democracies, condemned this because, after all, Lula is a leader of the left, a man of the left. Countries like Bolivia, like Cuba, that don't normally come out in defense of democracy, condemned what took place in Brazil, as did the United Nations and countries in really around the world. So the condemnation has been very swift and complete. And even within Brazil, the immediate public opinion polls show that the vast majority of Brazilians reject the violence that took place in the seat of government in Brasilia.
Cindy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thanks, Tyler.
That's Cindy Arnson, Distinguished Fellow and former director of the Wilson Center's Latin American program, joining us for a look at this weekend's events in Brazil, the attack on buildings in the capital there. Coming up, the four candidates running for state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin met yesterday to make their case ahead of this spring's election. We'll hear from one of the moderators of that forum about what we heard. That's coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. This spring, the ideological balance of Wisconsin's Supreme Court is up for grabs. Four candidates are running to replace conservative Justice Patience Rogensack, who is part of a 4-3 conservative majority. Two of those four candidates will advance past the February 21st primary to the general election on April 4th. Candidates took part in a forum yesterday put on by WIS Politics, where they shared their judicial visions and weighed in on some key issues in the state court system. Emily Fannin is the state politics and government reporter for CBS 58 in Madison. She co-moderated yesterday's candidate forum. I talked to her earlier today. She joined us from the state capitol building. Before we meet the candidates, can you set the stage for us with what's at stake in this big state Supreme Court election?
Well, of course, as we just wrapped up one big election, statewide election in November, everyone is now has their all eyes set on this state Supreme Court race. And what's really at stake is a lot of issues that we've already seen the state's high court already weigh in on, things like redistricting when it comes to the use of ballot drop boxes. And of course, the big lingering question going forward is when, as many are expected, the state's criminal abortion ban to be heard eventually before justices this year. Of course, that issue is still in the lower courts, but many people predict, just as the Attorney General Josh Call does, is that the justices will have some big decisions depending on reproductive rights in the near future.
Now, this is officially a nonpartisan election, meaning the candidates don't run as a Republican or a Democrat. In practice, we always know who the conservative-backed and liberal-backed candidates are. Let's touch base, starting with the two who have been more or less backed by the conservative side of the state. Who are those two candidates?
So those two candidates are former state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly, who is one conservative, and the other one is Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Duro. She, of course, presided over the Waukesha parade trial and her became very famous for her how she kind of handled that case. So she's trying to go off of her experience with that. Meanwhile, Daniel Kelly, even during the forum that we held this week, he also kind of reminded voters that, you know, I've already been in this position. He served 4 years on the bench. It was then Governor Scott Walker who had to fill a vacancy and appointed him then, but he lost in 2020 to a liberal-leaning candidate who is now serving on the bench.
And then we've got two candidates in this primary who are seen as backed more by Democrats and liberals. Who are they?
Right. That is Everett Mitchell, who is currently a Dane County judge, and Janet Protasiewicz, who is a currently a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Those are the both of the two liberals who had some interesting, highlights during yesterday's forum. But I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, let's get into that forum now. Now, it's tough with judicial candidates sometimes to get them to say anything, because the right. argument is, well, I don't want to say anything because I'm going to be a judge. I might have to hear this case. That said, one of the things you tackled is, as you mentioned, those redistricting maps. What were candidates willing to say about what they thought of the current state of affairs?
Right. I will say some were a little bit tight-lipped and others were not, which were the two liberal candidates. Now, it's important to note that every candidate up there did pledge to be fair and impartial if elected. But we know there's a lot of outside money that is poised to be spent. And I'm talking millions of dollars invested in this race that will be coming from the state Democrat and Republican Party. So while they say they're going to be fair and impartial, some of the highlights that we heard is the liberal candidates, Mitchell and Protasiewicz, both indicated on how they might rule on controversial issues such as abortion and redistricting. Specifically, I would say Protasiewicz was one of the most outspoken on there, calling the current maps that were enacted by the Supreme Court, called them rigged. And she said that a few times, really just letting people know that I don't think this is fair. And, you know, she said those are her values, but that was a clear sign that of how she might rule if she was elected to the bench. Now, Mitchell also said those maps are, you know, unfair right now. They don't fairly represent everyone, kind of comparing the differences between statewide elections and legislative and congressional races across Wisconsin.
Talking to Emily Fannin, state politics and government reporter for CBS 58 in Madison. She co-moderated yesterday's candidate forum featuring the four candidates in Wisconsin's state Supreme Court primary this election season. You asked candidates also about what they think a bad decision was by the U.S. Supreme Court decision. I think even maybe the worst decision. What kind of things did they point to?
So we had Mitchell and Protasiewicz both talk about Roe v. Wade being overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. They specifically answered that question. Now, we did not see Judge Durow did not answer that question, but we did reference in her question to her in her judicial appointment application. She did cite the overturning of a 2003 anti-sodomy law in Texas as the work decision by the high court. Meanwhile, Kelly referenced a 2005 decision where the court ruled that the government has this authority to take privately owned land and turn it over to a private developer. So he stood by that. Durow didn't really answer the question when we mentioned what she wrote in her application. And that was also something we saw kind of throughout the forum, that she kind of had prepared scripted remarks in front of her. And when we asked about specific cases, even about, say, Second Amendment rights, she didn't answer, but then kind of went back to her talking points of how she plans to be, you know, fair and impartial if she were to be elected.
Now, Emily, it's no secret. Elections here in Wisconsin can get a little bit heated. How would you describe the tone of the candidates and the way they talked to and about each other at this forum?
Well, when I watch these forums and when I listen back to them too, you try to find those aha moments. Now, this wasn't really a debate style, so we didn't see any of the candidates really take jabs at one another. The only highlight that I did see was Kelly did kind of knock Protasiewicz for when she said that her values, you know, when she mentioned that the redistricting maps were rigged. So Kelly kind of took a dig at her, saying, you know, if someone is already talking about their values, you know, we already kind of know how they're going to rule on a specific case. But other than that, I mean, everyone kind of kept to their same talking points. I will say during opening remarks, that was kind of, I would say, one of the strongest from all candidates, because, you know, not a lot of people, you know, we have a lot of political Whigs and politicos and here at the state capitol, a lot of people that are really invested in this race. But, you know, voters just got done with November's election. So I think now that they're getting kind of a sense of where these candidates stand and what their, issues are and what their campaign's all about, I think it's now going to start gaining a little bit more traction for people to kind of learn a little bit more about the candidates ahead of the February 21st primary.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Fannin is the state politics and government reporter for CBS 58 in Madison. I talked to her earlier today about the race for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. She joined us from the state capitol. You can find a link to the video of the candidate forum we mentioned there, which Emily co-moderated. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up on Thursday this week, are you a worrier? Do you worry? Does it keep you awake or distract you while you're awake? Well, help is on the way. We'll talk to a psychology expert who says we may not be able to stop our worrying, but we can do it better, more productively, and in ways that can give us less stress. Am I talking about you? Let us know about your worry habits and what you do about it. Maybe you have a question for our guest that we can share on Thursday. Maybe we can get an answer for you. let us know. Email now at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Let us know how you have learned to worry better or how you want to learn how to worry better. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, retirement planning has changed a lot in some ways over the years. Join Kate and her guests to get some advice on the new rules of retirement. And that's whether you're days away from retirement or decades away, there's some advice there for you. You can get started right now. Ask your question at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Or let us know what you've been doing to help us save for retirement, the challenges you faced along the way. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you're like most people, you probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about your local community's official flag. But some people do. A national flag design group just issued grades for communities around the country that have designed or redesigned their official flags lately. Wisconsin doesn't come out so good. As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there were 9 Wisconsin communities with flag designs since 2015. 7 of those got a failing grade from the North American Vexillological Association. What gives you a bad grade? Too many design elements, too many colors, words, and seals, too. The communities with failing grades were Franklin, West Allis, South Milwaukee, Kenosha, River Falls, De Pere, and Janesville. Hayward got a C for its flag. Madison pulled an A. I don't know, looking at it, Madison's flag is simple, sure, but maybe a bit boring. And some of those F flags may not follow the rules, but they bring some local color. Check out your local flag. You can often find them on a local government website. Let us know what you think. Email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time.